Look at this butt fuck. If that ain't a real story, what is?
Okay, let's fucking do it.
Hello, welcome to Popcorn and Prosecco, the movie podcast where we review three movies a week. And this week we're going to be reviewing The Interview, Annie, and The Hobbit. But you may look at your screen and go, wait a second, something's off. First off, Perry is not with us this week, so I'm hosting. And we brought in a special guest with Rudy Obias.
Hello, how are you all on this beautiful day?
I like that it's like the wind is blowing behind you and it looks really like beautiful day. So yeah, we're going to kick this podcast off by talking about The Interview, because everyone's talking about The Interview, and the three of us are apparently some of the few who have actually seen it. So Angie, you want to give us a plot description?
Yes.
I forgot to introduce Angie Han.
Hi.
This is why Perry does this.
You guys should know me by now, and if you don't, then I'm sad for you, because you've been deprived. But anyways, The Interview. So people have been talking about this a lot, but not because the movie is of any particular interest. I mean, it is, but that's not why people are talking about it. I'm sure you've heard by now all the Sony hack stuff and the terrorist threats and whatnot. And when we went to go see this movie, I did not realize that we were being treated to like a once-in-a-lifetime experience that nobody else was going to be able to have. But the point of the or the plot of the movie is James Franco plays Dave Skylark, who is a talk show host for like an entertainment talk show. Like, he talks to celebrities, and Seth Rogen is his producer. And Seth Rogen starts to feel like maybe he wants to do a little bit more serious journalism. So when James Franco looks into an opportunity to interview Kim Jong Il, the dictator of North Korea, they decide to go over to North Korea. And sometime after they make that announcement, but before they go, the CIA, who is represented by Lizzie Kaplan, comes and recruits them to assassinate Kim Jong-un. So then they agree and they go over to North Korea with the, you know, first to interview him and then second to kill him. And that's the movie. Randall Park plays Kim Jong-un. He's really good in the role, and
yeah.
I think it's actually, like, Seth Rogen and James Franco are already big stars, and they'll still be big stars after this, and they're still going to have every opportunity, but Randall Park, I thought that this could be, like, his breakout, because he's so funny in it.
I actually tweeted at him, and I was like, yo, for what it's worth, you were hysterical in this.
Yeah,
that's not bad.
That's one of the things I'm sad about, that this movie's not going to be seen, is that no one's going to witness this wonderful performance from Randall Park in the movie. I liked the movie. I thought the movie was kind of slow until Randall Park came into the movie. And
I agree. Before that, it feels a lot like their other shtick. It's the same thing where, again, Seth Rogen is like reluctant to be James Franco's friend, and James Franco is kind of douchey and really wants to be Seth Rogen's friend. And I'm not that I'm tired of that dynamic, but it's something we've seen before. And then you bring in Randall Parks as Kim Jong-un, and it's this whole new thing because, like, James Franco really likes him, but Seth Rogen doesn't trust him. And Randall Parks is just hits it out of the park. He makes Kim Jong-un weirdly sympathetic for a chunk of the movie, which I did not expect. I mean, like, he's not a good guy. He's presented as a douchebag, to be perfectly honest. And then things get more, dictator-y. That's not a word. It's been a long day, guys. I've been kind of going crazy. Anyway, I think it's actually a pretty funny movie. It wouldn't even be in my top 10 of movies that came out this year, comedy-wise, but, like, it was funny, and it's so strange. And we said this when we saw it, which was, like, a week or so ago now, 2 weeks ago maybe, that it was, like, it's crazy that all this is happening because of this movie that just feels like a dumb stoner comedy. And since then, all hell has broken loose.
Yeah, like right now, this is like one of the most important movies of 2014. I don't know how it happened, but it is
potentially of the past 100 years, depending on how this goes.
Because of all the stuff that has happened, it's turned what would have otherwise been like a fun comedy that we enjoyed over Christmas and then didn't really think about that much afterward until it hit HBO, to being like, you know, an important movie.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot, honestly, of The Dictator that came out a couple years ago. Yeah, from 2012, that nobody gives a shit about now, and nobody talks about now. I thought it was going to be like that. And yeah, I get that Kim Jong-un is a real guy, but it's a fucking comedy with Seth Rogen. Like, it's weird to me that something like that can be taken this seriously. And, like, it has been predated, because some people are going to say, well, The Dictator wasn't a real thing. Well, you know what? The Great Dictator was a real thing. That was Charlie Chaplin full-on being like, fuck you, Hitler. And that was in the middle of World War II. So this has happened before. It's just with the age of the internet, it's a whole new thing, and I don't know. I don't want to get super into the hacker aspect of this, but just for those listening, at this point in time, this is, we're recording this after Sony has canceled in entirety the interview, and after Paramount has canceled even Screening Team America in place of the interview.
I want to talk about that, actually. I want to talk about the movie as a movie, but I also want to talk about that a little bit more. One of the other, one of the other things that's happened as a result of all that Sony stuff is that Universal has canceled the movie it was planning to make called Pyongyang with Gore Verbinski and Steve Carell.
Yeah.
And to me, people are so mad at Sony right now. They're like, oh, you're letting the terrorists win by, like, not showing the movie. And I see their point, but I also completely understand why Sony would be like, well, we are not fucking taking the risk of someone dying at a screening and getting in so much trouble for this. I'm a little bit more mad at Universal for canceling their movie that hasn't even started shooting.
Well,
yet.
I mean, Hollywood is very reactionary, right? I mean, all the movies that we're seeing in theaters are reactions to other movies. So I think it makes sense that they're having this knee-jerk reaction to Sony pulling the interview. I mean, I'm not happy that people aren't going to see this film. I'm not happy that people aren't going to see Team America, World Police, in place.
Which is on Netflix, by the way, guys. So watch Team America on Netflix.
Yeah, Christy, I actually just read your list of what to watch in lieu of the interview on Pajiba. So congratulations.
I did a piece called Charlie Fuck Chappell. Tyranny, and it has a bunch of movies that are about tyranny being the shitty. And you should watch them all.
Yeah, the gif of Charlie Chaplin as the header was just a highlight of that whole piece. But I thought the interview was going to make a lot of money when it came out anyway, just because it is Seth Rogen.
Well, like, the Neighbors made $150. So, like...
And I don't see why they wouldn't release this movie now that everyone wants to watch it. It seems really reactionary. I really want people to see this film. I don't think it is as good as all the hype that's surrounding it, obviously.
I don't think anyone's saying it's that great. I think it's just that I think it's a solid comedy.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely solid, but there are... It's a little long. It should be trimmed.
It is a little long.
I mean, this is a movie that's important not on its own merits as a movie, but because of all the stuff that's happened around it. I mean,
yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
But going back to actually talking about the movie as a movie, which we should talk about because now we are part of the very rare class of people who have actually seen this movie.
Apparently, this movie has only screened three times. This movie has only screened three times.
Really?
And we were in one of the three times this
movie
screened. Guys,
we were making history.
That feels really strange. Like, when you think
about
the movie...
There was a screening in L.A., and New York, and Butnamathon, and that was it.
Wow.
Wow.
See, that's so crazy, because, like, okay, you think about the movies that came out this year, and some of them were especially hard to see or whatever for various reasons. It's crazy to me that this is the movie, and that hasn't stopped people from writing think pieces that they haven't seen the damn thing. And let me tell you right now, I am just full stop against writing, like, a criticism of a movie if you haven't seen the fucking movie. That's just full stop. I don't care what the movie is. That just, it's driving me nuts. But we were talking about the actual movie, which is solidly funny. It's a plot that, like, you've essentially know all about because it's all over the news. And yeah, Kim Jong-un bites it in the end, and you may have seen that clip, and you may have thought, well, this doesn't seem terribly funny, but one, you're not seeing in context, and two, it's not played totally for jokes. It's an emotionally complicated moment.
Well, the moment at the end where he does die, I mean, it builds pretty well, I thought. Like, the movie turns into this, like, rat-a-tat-tat action film in the climax, which I was totally surprised about. And I think Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg do a great job setting...
Who directed it, we should say. We've missed
the directors of the film, who set up this great action beat at the end of the film. And so everything builds and builds and builds and builds to that point when we hear that Katy Perry song. I was more surprised at the level of filmmaking from the climax of the movie more so than the comedy. Like, I would like to see Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg one day do an action film.
That's interesting. I didn't feel that way, but it's mainly because I think that with the action stuff, they have the same mistake they have with their comedy, where they just don't know when to let it go. Like, there's a scene where Seth Rogen fights a guy, and multiple fingers get bitten off between that, and I was just like, what? Like, it, like, was funny the first time, and the second time I was like, what? And then the third time I was like, I don't know what's happening anymore. It feels so weird to, like, sometimes we review movies we understand it's going to be hard for you to see. It feels really strange reviewing a movie that you may never see, but the simple fact of the matter and why we decided to review this anyway is because there are so many people shooting their mouths out about this movie one way or the other. I think we felt that we had to say something because we actually saw it. I would love to know the numbers on who's actually seen this movie at this point. This
you remember at our screening, like, there's like, half full. Like, our screening wasn't even packed.
I mean, there have been test screenings and stuff, but it can't possibly be that many people. I thought that the biggest strength of this movie is the same thing that, you know, it's the same, it's the usual Seth Rogen thing. It's a good, like, bro-y movie. It's got, like, a fun bro-y relationship between him and James Franco.
The female characters are disposable, as they always are in these movies.
Yes, but I did, despite that, I do have to say I was very happy to see Lizzie Kaplan, who is not in it that much, but since she started with them on Freaks and Geeks, I had a little bit of a moment of, like, celebration.
I don't know if you noticed this, but after this, we saw our next movie, which I'll get to in a second, but we were talking about Lizzie Kaplan's boobs from this movie, and then someone behind me was like, "Are you a screener?" And I was like, "What?" And they were basically asking if it's my job to see movies for a living, and I thought, I want to know what the fuck he thought we were talking about. Like, for 10 minutes easily, we were being like, those weren't Lizzie Kaplan's boobs.
Yeah.
You don't see them in this movie. Sorry.
There's a lot of cleavage.
It's that bro-y relationship.
Well, there are boobs in the movie. Not that anyone's going to see them, but there are boobs, but they're not Lizzie Kaplan's boobs.
But yeah, it's a bro-y relationship, but then they also bring Kim Jong-un to the mix, who weirdly fits into that kind of tone really well, and it becomes like a weird bro relationship with him. But yeah, overall, I would say people should go see it if they're in the mood for a comedy over Christmas, but you know, now you can't, so maybe check out Christy's suggestions of other things you could watch. What about you guys?
I think you, if this movie was coming out, I think you should see it as your patriotic duty as an American to watch this movie. But even if all of that stuff wasn't attached to it, I would still recommend people. I mean, I don't think it's as good as This Is the End, but
no, it's not as crazy. Which
no, it's not as crazy as that. That movie, like, I kept me guessing throughout the whole thing, and this one does a little bit. But I would still recommend people go watch it if it were coming out.
Yeah, I thought it was solidly funny. I thought that the two guys had a lot to do. I thought Randall Parks was great and really made this a standout. But you can't see it, so it's fucked up, guys. I don't know.
Humble brag.
It's not even. I feel like it's such a fucking stupid thing that we get to see this movie and other people don't, because, I mean, like, it's just, it's not nearly as inciting as I think some people seem to think it is.
Yeah, but North Korea is, like, they're not really known for their ability to take a joke.
Watch Team America, guys. If you want more suggestions, go to Pajiba. I have a whole bunch.
Anyway, so moving on
to the other Sony movie that's coming out at Christmas. And guys, bad news for Sony, this is not good either. I mean, like, the interview was good and they can't open it, and this is not good, and it's opening. Annie. And guys, my co-host didn't even want to talk about Annie, because who cares? I did. I cared a whole lot. All right, so Annie.
Hey, I was an orphan in my middle school's production of Annie, I will have you know.
I thought you were just going to be like, I was an orphan, and I was like, why don't I know that? Like, I was
why didn't I know that? I was like, were you adopted?
That's what I was thinking. I was having a lot of emotions in like 2 seconds. It was happening. Anyway, Annie, in case you don't know, is a story of a scrappy little orphan that happens to meet a super well guy who has a heart and decides that for PR reasons he will take her in and like live with him for a little bit. And it is, as you can tell, it's a musical. It's a story that is weird in a modern context. You know, their attempts to modernize it do not help things. Like, they're like, we won't call her an orphan, we'll call her a foster kid, but this is the least of their problems. But it's directed by Will Gluck, which I was actually excited to see it, because I enjoy Will Gluck. He did Easy A and Fired Up and Friends with Benefits, and I think all of those are fucking fun. But this movie is wildly not, and there are so many things wrong with it, chief among them the fact that nobody gave a shit if the main characters could sing or dance, even though they make them sing and dance repeatedly. Cameron Diaz cannot sing. If you've ever seen any of her movies where she sings, you know that. And they don't have the balls to replace her, which I don't know why. And it's supposed to be a joke that she can't sing, which is offensive and stupid. And like, they actually make fun of the fact that it's a musical throughout the whole damn thing. I was infuriated. Worst of all, Kavenzie Wallace is adorable. But she can't sing and she can't dance.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Kavenjane Wallace has an amazing screen presence when she's not singing and dancing. And I think she's adorable. I think she's actually going to have a career in the future.
But maybe not in a
Broadway musical. I didn't think she was going to have much of a career after Beast of the Southern Wild, but in this movie, my biggest takeaway is that she does have a great screen presence and she's very charming. But I agree with you, Christy, that I think the modernizing this movie or making an attempt to modernize the source material really hampers how this film plays to modern audiences. I think the filmmakers were too obsessed with updating it and making it contemporary and losing sight of what makes Annie work as a story and that it is set in a certain time period.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very confusing. Like, for one thing, the movie has a weirdly, like, weird messages about capitalism and about class.
And privacy.
And these are all weird attempts to modernize it. Like, the whole thing where Jamie Foxx's, Daddy Warbucks equivalent has a political career is, like, a really weirdly big part of the plotline. And it's just like, what little kids care that much if Jamie Foxx is the mayor of New York?
Instead of, like, I never understood what Daddy Warbucks did, and someone told me recently he was a war profiteer,
Yeah,
that's why he's called Warbucks.
That makes sense. I didn't realize that as a kid, but, like, they draw a lot of attention in this movie to how Will stacks, which I'm assuming is supposed to be, like, stacks of cash,
yeah, stacks of cash.
Early on, it was reported that he was going to be called Benjamin Stacks. You know, like stacks of Benjamins, but I think that they decided that was too on the nose, so they decided to just call
him. It's stuff like that throughout the whole film that really takes away from what this movie should be, or at least what the source material is.
And, like, they tend to spend all this time in the movie setting up what Will Stacks' business is, which is cell phones, and then they set up this whole, like, Batman Dark Knight Returns thing, where he has the ability to, like, track and listen in on every phone that is in his system, which is horrifying, but the movie doesn't seem to recognize that, and they're just like, yeah, he can do that. And then
There's a part where you learn that he has hidden, like, a cell phone tower in, like, the Statue of Liberty, and it's just like, you defaced the national monument, and, like, the movie's like, isn't it great? And you're just like, no, not great, weird, awful.
There's a lot of fundamental ways in which this film does not understand how New York operates. It's like trying so hard to be a New York City film, and you're just like, no, people would put your head on a pike, dude. You don't just deface a national monument and be like, cell phone towers. And, like, the movie never acknowledges this. Like, basically, Will Stacks is a goddamn Bond villain that hasn't figured it out yet. And, like, the movie just never behaves that way. It's so bizarre.
I want to say the least believable thing in the movie to me, though, was, so at one point, you know, Stacks is crazy rich, but at one point he reveals that he actually grew up working class. He's a politician who's getting slammed in the polls for being too elitist.
Yeah, because he's like, don't tell anybody.
Yeah, I find it, and he acts like it's a big secret that he comes from a working class background. I'm like, there's no fucking way that an American politician getting slammed for being too upper class would be hiding the fact that he's working class and that he worked his way up. That's the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's
the whole movie is full of, like, weird inconsistencies like that just, like, don't make that much sense.
There's, like, tone-deaf jokes. Like, there's a joke about Hurricane Sandy in this movie.
What'd they say? They're talking about the dog.
Yeah. Yeah, he goes, that dog's a hurricane. And she goes, I'm going to name it Sandy. And, like, what? That's not funny.
The name of the dog is Sandy.
But, like, they didn't need to say the hurricane thing. It's just, it's so bizarre.
Well, I think it really does stem from the fact that this movie is trying its hardest to be contemporary. It is trying its hardest to be
to the point of not the original, which I find really insulting.
Like, the thing is, like, because it is trying so hard to be an updated version, it automatically dates it as soon as you leave the theater. Like, this is always going to be time-stamped of 2014, rather than, the original 1982 Annie that, you know, you watch that film, you don't think it's from the 80s because it looks like it's from the 30s.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing about it is that it's just, I feel like they made it modern to try to get kids to like it, down to the fact that there's a Twilight parody in this movie.
That's actually one of the best jokes.
It actually is, but that's the thing. It has nothing to do with the fucking movie. The thing that everybody, like, that I've been talking to actually enjoyed about this is a parody that has nothing to do with the plot of the film.
No, and the thing is, the whole movie, it's a two-hour movie. It feels like a three-hour movie. It's just way too long. It's way too shaggy and stuff like that. As much as I enjoyed the parody, you're absolutely right. They should have cut that because it has nothing to do with the film. It doesn't advance the plot. It has no thematic relevance. And all it does is add time to a movie that already feels ridiculously long. Like, halfway through the movie, whenever, like, music would start up, I'd just be like, oh, no, not a another.
Especially because they would just announce what the song is as if there should be a thing on screen being like, buy it now on iTunes. But, like, the one girl would be like, it's a hard knock life. And then literally be like, ba-ba-da, ba-ba. And you're like, they couldn't just go into song. Like, what is happening? And it kept happening. And, oh, this movie makes me so crazy.
It never kind of, it, it is so shy about just fully committing to the fact that it's a classic musical. Like, there are all these, like, weird ways that the movie tries to be like, oh, you know, but we're self-aware, or like, oh, it's
like, we're too good to be a musical, is the running joke. Where, like, at one point someone's like, are you really singing right now? And, like, there's a part where, like, everybody loves musicals, and it's, like, it's ashamed of being a musical. It makes fun of the original from the first scene, which is literally a little redhead girl named Annie sings.
Honestly, I thought that the first scene, the one that, I know it got you riled up right off the bat, but I just thought it was, like, a funny reference.
Yeah, because it was like, oh, did you like the original? Well, fuck you.
No, I thought it was more just, like, you know, like, a gentle, like, nudge and being like, you know, that's...
But then there's a line later where it calls back one of my favorite things from the first movie, which is just Miss Hannigan in her entirety. And it's the girls go, we love you, Miss Hannigan. And she goes, shut up. No one buys that. And it's like, that's not, shut up. Anyway, but what makes me sad about this is I was totally on board for the idea of doing a quote-unquote modern Annie. Not necessarily contemporary. That seemed like a weird idea to me. But I didn't mind them remaking it because I'm afraid this is going to come off like I was like, I love the original because I grew up with it and I do love it. I don't even care that parts of it are stupid and weird. But like this one, they had a chance to do something really great. And I think it was awesome that they were like, we're going to go with the Black Annie. And I thought that was exciting and like was really looking forward to what that means for little girls who get to see themselves on screen in a way that they don't generally get to see. Because really, think about it, how many famous little black actresses are there out there? There's Quvenzhané Vene Wallace, and that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, which
that's
is why we always knew she was going to get cast, and it's why she got cast, despite
because,
the fact
because, yeah, because Willow Smith was like, peace out, and then they were like, well, there's this other girl. And then, like, seriously, who else can you name? Like, there's a million pretty little white girls up and coming on Disney Channel and everything else. But this was exciting, and I have to say, there were little girls in the theater that were so excited by the movie, and I was excited for them, but also mad that this movie's not good enough for them.
I actually thought that there were a few moments in the movie that I thought were pretty charming. A lot of it has to do with how charming Quvenzhané Wallace is, despite the fact that she's not much of a singer or dancer. Some of it had to do with nostalgia of like the musical numbers that I liked, which, as we've talked about, they don't fully commit to, and some of them aren't great. But you know, you still get I would still be like, oh, they're singing that song, you know, and I'd be a little bit happy. But it's just the pleasures of this movie are too few and far in between for me to think that this is a thing I want to recommend to other people watch.
Yeah, I think the best things in the movie are Quvenzhané Wallace and Jamie Foxx.
No, Bobby Cannavale. I thought he was...
The moment he started singing and dancing was the moment I was like, is he really going to do a musical number now?
No, that made me happy because it's one of the songs from the original that's fun, and two, that they actually don't totally bastardize in this. Like, when Bobby Cannavale started singing, I was like, that's what singing is, everyone! Because so many people in this cannot sing.
I just thought it was awkward seeing him in a musical number. I'm like, are we really going to do this now? And they did it. I'm like, okay, let's see where this goes.
At least he could sing. I'm so angry at how many people in this movie just can't sing. And they're like, you know, Audrey Hepburn couldn't sing in My Fair Lady, and they were just like, well, bring somebody in, like Singing in the Rain style. Fine, make that happen.
Well, they can't do that anymore. Unfortunately. Why? Well, you remember when Natalie Portman in Black Swan got a lot of flack for not dancing?
No, I remember when people tried to act like that was a big deal.
I mean, that would be another thing like this again, you know? Like,
I don't buy that.
People want to see their celebrities singing and dancing.
I think this movie thought it would be funny if, like, I think they ran with the fact that their leads couldn't sing, and I think that's terrible.
I mean,
we should wrap this up and move on to our final episode. I'm sorry, is there anything else you want to add to this?
No, let's go on to that, the Hobbit.
Would you recommend Annie to anyone?
Well, what else is coming out this weekend for families to see?
Night
at the Museum's out, and Big Hero 6 is still out.
Yeah, and Into the Woods will open next week.
I don't think Annie is that good of a family film, because I feel like if you're a small child and you have a short attention span, then it's not a good movie for you. But yeah, if that's all we have to say about Annie... I'm going to talk about another movie that stars people of short stature, The Hobbit. That was actually Christie's
We're killing it on segue today, guys. I'm really proud of us.
Go us. So, The Hobbit. Not just The Hobbit. The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, because we had to split this what should have been one movie, up into three movies. And boy, does it feel like it. So, The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. This is going to be a challenge, because... it picks up exactly where the last one left off. I had forgotten a lot of what happened in the last movie, so when I walked in the movie, I was like, what's going on? Oh, right. So So it starts with Smaug is over in Lake Town, attacking Lake Town. The people fight back. Eventually, he dies. I don't think that's a spoiler because it happens. It's like the first thing that happens in the movie. So yeah, they had like a this massive cliffhanger from the last film that they just like wrap up in like the first 5 minutes of this movie. It's the only time in this movie it's the only time that this movie decides to do anything quickly, because then the rest of it is a really long, joyless slog about how
five armies battle.
Right. So I'm trying to remember what happens after that. Oh, all right. So Smaug destroys Lake Town. The people are, I don't know, trying to figure out how to rebuild. Meanwhile, the elves want a piece of jewelry that's in like the castle where the dwarves and Bilbo are hanging out. Also, there are orcs that want something for some reason. They're all converging to the same place.
dwarves show up.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the dwarves.
People of Lake Town.
Right. Meanwhile, the dwarves, the ones that are in this like giant castle, the one where Smaug was kicked out of in the last movie, Thorin is looking for something called the Arkenstone, which is like a magical stone that will make him king of the dwarves or something like that. But because he's there, he comes down with a case of quote-unquote dragon sickness, which is the same thing as just becoming a really greedy dick. To me, this was like the dumbest thing in the movie, because all the dwarves are just like, oh my god, Thorin has dragon sickness.
It was my favorite thing, because
the guy who Thorin has been an asshole for like both of them.
Well, he's been a broody douche noble causes.
What happens is that he's been a broody douche, and then he becomes a broody douche with money and power, and it makes him more of a broody douche, and the dwarves are so surprised by this that they pretend it's an illness, and they call it, quote-unquote, dragon sickness. It should be called, like, beaverism or something.
I would love that version. But I actually really like that about it, because I thought Richard Armitage's, like, performance is so campy, and so, like, I just kept imagining him as, like, Joan Crawford, like, hanging on stairwells and being like, I need my orb, and just being like, it was lovely. Like, I loved him being all beardy and diva, and it was fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, him and Lee Pace in this, they are the only thing
I love. But because Thorin has dragon sickness and is being a complete douche and doesn't want to give the elves their jewelry and doesn't want to help the people rebuild Lake Town, and the orcs hate everyone, so, you know, everyone's, like, fighting this battle of the five armies in front of the castle, the fifth army shows up really late. It's like it's weird how much it matters and at the same time how little weight the narrative gives it. The battle is the vast majority of this movie, so you just see it's just one really long battle sequence. You just see fight after fight. There are like fights between characters. You know, there are fights.
It doesn't feel like a movie. It feels like an action sequence that goes on for less than the other two movies, at least. I was actually really excited when I was like, oh, this is only a little over 2 hours. But
it doesn't feel shorter though.
No, but there's no arc to it. It's not like, because we were discussing this when we reviewed Catching Fire, Mockingjay, about whether or not, even though it is part of a larger story, it felt like a film like that had a story that you got to follow beginning to end. And this doesn't feel like that. This literally just feels like previously on The Hobbit, and then into the thing, and then stuff happens. There's no, it's meant to be like the finale episode of a TV show, but I don't find that satisfying in a film, because in a TV show, maybe I have to wait a week to see who dies and who lives in big showdowns. But when I'm waiting like a legit year, this isn't fun.
Also, most good TV shows, even if it's a really serialized storyline, they'll have like a sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end within the episode. Like, there will be... They'll tie it up together somehow if it's a good show. The Hobbit doesn't do that. It just kind of, like, plunges you into this scene of Smaug destroying Lake Town without reminding you. I actually wish there was a previously on, because I was like, what's going on? And it took me a while to remember. It plunges you in the dirt with no warning, and then it just keeps going, and then eventually it stops. And that's, like, how this movie goes. For me, the only time that it worked at all, I think Martin Freeman in this movie is so good, and the movie is never better than... Well, it's never better than when one of two things happens. One, either he shows up, or number two, Lee Pace does, because Martin Freeman's performance is so warm and, I think, grounded, and it has so much of the heart and humanity that everyone else and everything else about this movie is missing. And in the few he doesn't get that much screen time, but when he does, I feel like those were the times where I was like, oh, right, like, he reminds me of why this was going to be a movie that was a good idea to make.
I think that's one of the problems of the film is that you just said that Martin Freeman doesn't have a lot of screen time when the movie is called The Hobbit. You know, and ostensibly this movie is supposed to, or all these movies are supposed to be about him.
It's also called The Battle of the Five Armies, and that takes up, like, all the screen time, so there you go.
Absolutely, it feels like a video game cutscene.
Yeah,
so than anything else.
It also looks like one because it's so heavily CG'd.
I think this is the best of the three Hobbit movies, but that's not really saying much. I think it's the best because it's the shortest.
Because now we're done.
And exactly, now that we're done, it's a backhanded compliment that I'm paying to this movie. I'm not a big fan of the Hobbit films. I am a big fan of the Lord of the Rings movies. And the things that made those movies special somehow got lost in the three movies that Peter Jackson made here.
I would have liked this as one movie. I think I would have enjoyed that.
When the Blu-ray comes out of this, someone's going to cut all three movies into three and a half hour film, and that's what we're going to enjoy. I'm looking forward to that next year.
Peter Jackson keeps releasing extended versions of these, and I'm like, no, what you need to do is sit down and smush them all together into 1 2-hour movie.
Especially because, like, he made such a big deal out of, like, look, we've added a lady character for ladies. But she's so goddamn dull, and, like, in this, she is just damsel in distress times two, and it's like, wait, you set her up as this amazing warrior, and now she is literally falling all over herself to get rescued. It's so frustrating. Like, I would have rather they had never created Toriel, because she is a tired trope we don't need any more of.
And I liked her in the last one a little bit, but in this one, you're right, she doesn't really do anything.
And I think one of the things, I'm not a big fan of this movie, like, the ending felt somewhat abrupt, if I can say that.
Like, that battle sequence goes on, it's over.
He says goodbye to the dwarves, and now he's back in Hobbiton. I'm like, well, what happened? Like...
Yeah,
this ending just happened out of nowhere, and now the credits are rolling.
They also spent a great deal of time trying to connect it to Lord of the Rings, which, does anybody need that?
No, there's an entire side plot, which, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I have heard that it is not from the books, where Gandalf has, like, a little side adventure that involves Cate Blanchett and Hugo Weaving, and Saruman and Sauron, and apparently that's not from the books. There's also, like, a weird thing at the end where they set up Legolas going to go hang out with Aragorn for, again, no reason.
Yeah, it's like they're tie-ins that we don't really need. I mean, it's not even, like, Easter eggs and stuff. It's just, like, get it? Like the other movies we did? And you're like, no, yeah, I got that. I just feel like Peter Jackson is not... I don't like him as a filmmaker, and this comes not just from now, but this, like, I just don't feel like he has grown as a filmmaker. I feel like...
He's regressed, if anything.
Yeah, I feel like he gets these big ideas and generally can't tell, like, when to fucking edit. It makes me sad. I wanted to enjoy this movie, and there are some very cool action sequences in it. There's one scene in particular with the dwarves and the elves that I thought was really fun and literally started giggling. I was like, that's cool looking! But, like, so much of it, I'm just like, I don't know who these people are, or I don't care what's happening anymore, or I've completely lost focus because this is just such a long sequence. And then, like, there's this whole thing where they have dwarves scaling the mountain to fight orcs, and it just goes on for so long.
Well, I think that's one of the problems of the film. I have absolutely no idea who these dwarves are. After three long movies, I have no idea what their names are, what their personalities are, or anything
absolutely.
About
them. I know Kiwi's the cute one, because they keep being
that's
like,
that's the only one I know. And
There's Thorin, there's either Feely or Kiwi, who's a cute one, and then there's Balin or Dwalin, who's like an old guy that's always giving Bilbo sage advice.
But that seems like a big problem, though. Like, we spent 9 hours with these characters, and we know nothing about them. Not even their names. And
it's a big problem.
And they spend so much time with, like, differentiating them, how they look, but at the same time, like, I don't know who they are. So what's the point of making them look different if I don't know what their names are?
I did see this in 3D, and I had forgotten that, so I feel like that speaks
and
to the
a lot of this movie just feels like a ride. Like, you go in excited, you really don't think of how this works as a film, and when you're done, you're like, okay, that was nice, but...
Except the ride is, like, 1 minute long.
This is
a lot of minutes long. I'm sorry, I'm still bitter, but we should wrap up lest our podcast become like The Hobbit and just keep going. You like that? So, in conclusion, I mean, if you've seen all the other ones and you're like, well, I might as well fucking finish this, then I guess
I think the only reason to see this is out of obligation if you've seen the last two movies.
Yeah, basically. If you're just like, look, I've already wasted enough of my life on this and I'm never going to get those hours back and you just want to cut your losses, that's probably the smart choice and that's what I recommend you do.
Yeah. I feel bad. My mom was asking me if she should see this, and she really likes those books. And I was just like, I feel like you could just wait for DVD.
Did like, she see the last two movies?
I believe she did. I don't know if she saw them in theaters, though.
Okay.
I don't remember. I just think that this is a lot to ask for someone to pay a lot of money and sit there for this many hours. Like, if it's like a lazy Saturday at your house, I don't think that's a problem. But this doesn't have a story. It's just the final chapter. It's just very frustrating.
It's just stuff that happens. And yeah. It looks nice.
Yeah. In conclusion, I have realized that the secret theme of this week's episode was things that go on for way too long. And now our podcast has gone on for a while, so Chrissy?
So thank you for joining us on Popcorn and Prosecco. You can find more of us on iTunes, where we have an audio version of the show and a video version of the show. Please rate us and rank us and all that good stuff. And please subscribe. We're also on popcornprosecco.com. We are also on Twitter at Popcorn Prosecco. We are on Facebook, Popcorn and Prosecco. And let's do our own personal tweets. Rudy, where can we find you online?
You can find me at mentalfloss.com or moviepilot.com. And you can also find me on Twitter, twitter.com/Rudy_Obias. That's RUDIE_OBIAS.
Angie, you want to take it?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at AJHAN. And you can find my writing at slashfilm.com.
And I am at Christy Puchko at, I write all over the place, guys. You can find highlights of my work on decadentcriminals.com, and do check out my piece for Pajiba about what you should be watching that's not The Interview. So we'll see you next week at Christmas, guys. It's a weird episode. Thanks for joining us, Rudy.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to raise my little piece of Interview swag that is apparently now a historical relic.
Hater's gonna hate, and ainer's gonna ain't.